Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 202, featuring Matthew Butler and Kelly Port, both from Digital Domain. In fact, they are not only veterans of the industry, but veterans of Digital Domain. They have both been at Digital Domain for 24 years and have been doing this for a very, very long time. It was absolutely wonderful to talk to them. I was at, I recorded the podcast in Malta for Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn. So it was in September of 2018 or earlier this year. And it was really just a great, great time. I absolutely loved THU, and I hopefully they enjoyed it as much as I do every year. I recorded this podcast in a hotel courtyard. It was the best thing we could find at the time. We were going to try to record it outside since the weather seemed nice, but unfortunately it was so windy. We had to find a place that was shielded us from the wind, which we did, which was in this courtyard, but it was a little bit echoey. So I had to treat the audio a little bit to try to remove some of the echo. And it may seem a little bit treated, but I think it still sounds pretty good. So you can definitely understand what we're talking about, which is great. Had an absolutely wonderful time talking to them. Matthew, and I've known Matthew since he was my very first visual effects supervisor in feature films. He was my soup on Day After Tomorrow. And it was absolutely wonderful and a great inspiration and mentor at that time. And then Kelly was my DFX supervisor on Stealth, so a few of my, which was my third show over there. And I really had a great time talking to them and sort of going over the history of how they got to do what they do and how things have changed over the last 24 years of their time at Digital Domain. Really, really great chatting with them. They were at THU to talk about two films that they had done this year, which were really great. The first one for Matthew. Matthew was the Digital Domain VFX supervisor on Ready Player One, and so that was a really cool show to talk about. And then Kelly was the DD VFX soup on Avengers Infinity War, and we talked about that. Now, we've actually talked about Thanos and Infinity Wars quite a bit, but it was really cool to hear Kelly's perspective on that. So thanks so much for those two guys and two great mentors of mine for being on. We don't really have any big announcements this week compared to anything else. We're sort of between announcements right now of anything new that we're doing. So what I'm going to ask is instead, why don't you guys make sure and check in with us on our social media channels. We are on Facebook, if you want to check that out. It is CG Garage Podcast for on Facebook. That is our Facebook page. We have all the announcements we have there. We also have a Twitter, which is just CG_labs. And if you have emails, if you want to email us about any ideas or comments or whatever, you can just do that as well. That's labs@chaosgroup.com. Also a reminder that we would love to hear from you on iTunes. If you guys want to rate us and review us on iTunes, we are available there. Just look up CG Garage and go ahead and rate us and review us there. It would be much appreciated. All right, guys. Thank you so much. With that being said, please enjoy this fantastic podcast with Matthew Butler and Kelly Port from Digital Domain, recorded in Malta at THU 2018. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I am really, really excited about the fact that you guys are here at THU for two reasons. One is THU is one of my passions. I love this event. It's one of my favorite things. It's the thing that bonds me to people the most. And I want to share it with people I know. Yeah. And that's something that is really exciting you guys are here. And one of the things that's even more exciting is that you two guys were at the beginning of my visual effects career and had a huge influence on that, right? So my first movie was Day After Tomorrow, and you were my visual effects supervisor right on there. And then I worked with you on Stealth right after that, uh-huh. You know, and you're my DFX supervisor on Stealth. And there's lots of great stories behind a lot of those things that we did together, but I learned a lot from you guys. I learned a lot from you, not just in terms of how visual effects works, but how to talk to people, how to give direction to people, how to deal with issues. And that was my first lesson in terms of that level of creative mentorship that I ever had. And I really appreciate what that was about. So first of all, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Our pleasure, yeah.
Yeah, and it was really important to me. So hold on, I'm just going to adjust this a little bit.
It's funny to think of people learning from us. Yeah.
why is that so?
Well, because, you know, we weren't educated in this field, right?
Right.
Prior to being at Digital Domain.
Right.
Because when Kelly and I started, we started in the same year, in 1994, there were literally no schools. You couldn't go to school for visual effects.
Right.
To my knowledge, at least.
No.
And you've said something there, and I've heard that from other people before. They say, oh, they've learned stuff from us. I think, God, what did you learn? Because I don't feel like I'm qualified to teach. But I guess over time, one absorbs information from, I guess I learned from my peers and have just carried that same misinformation onto you guys.
Well, I'll give you a very specific example. Okay. When we were on day, what I learned from you was to learn how to think and how to question things and how to analyze things. And I'll give you another more specific example. There was a question, and actually I wonder if you have the answer to this question, because I still haven't figured it out. Do lens flares have motion blur?
Ah.
Do you remember this question?
I think I do.
Yeah,
I think I do, and I'm probably no more the wiser, but anything that moves during the time of an exposure
would blur,
right? It doesn't really matter, right? Like, it's back when we were doing this. This is pre-digital, too, right?
Right, so, it was on film.
So the gate opens, light does its dance, exposes the emulsion, and the gate closes, right? On the shutter, I should say, not the gate. If that information is traversing across the back of the plane during that exposure, then it will motion blur. Whether that happens with the lens or not, I don't know.
But don't you think that just the fact that you asked that question and that you were bringing that up teaches someone to think about that question?
Yes, I see.
Teaching is not about giving answers. Teaching is about figuring out how to ask questions.
Yeah, and I think that's what we had with Spades because of our handicap. When we started, there wasn't the schooling, right? And we were really just figuring shit out, right? I referred to us as a sort of, you know, the RAND Corporation, where you just employed a bunch of quite eclectic people from all sorts of different avenues, aspects of the world,
right,
who were just kind of bold enough to go, all right, we'll figure this shit out. And, you know, yeah, we'll say, yes, we can do it. And then we'll go get in a room and say, how the fuck are we going to do it? So I think because of that, it forced us to have to think, because we had to.
Right.
You couldn't look it up in a manual, right? It wasn't an answer on page 17. It was, I don't know.
Right.
Is that the way you feel about it?
Yeah, I was just thinking back to one of the first, there's so many little problems. It's always like, you know, whether it's a different project, like for example, one of my first ones was Titanic, and dealing with this is the funny credit that I had, the digital paraphernalia supervisor, which was this group of 5 to 10 artists doing effects work for just random stuff that sort of no one had really accounted for, I think, even though they obviously should have, but like smoke coming out of the stacks, seagulls flying, bow wakes. And I remember at the time being on some boat, like, and just looking over the bow, and these problems just haunt you. Like I remember staying up at night thinking about bow wakes and how to, because we didn't sim it then. Like, computationally, like fluid sims were not really a feasible.
That was not
in a
solution
in a timeline.
Right,
so we had to sort of cheat it, figure it out, and
right.
And I mean, nowadays you can run a sim and it goes from a solid to a spray to a surface to foam. You can kind of evolve that simulation into what looks very realistic. But we have to just sort of look at a phenomenon happening, you know, observe it, and you constantly think of how can I, what is it that's going on? What am I actually seeing visually, regardless of whether it's physically correct or not? You know, just like observe what's happening physically, and then try to just imagine how you would recreate that in as realistic a way as possible.
Yeah.
But I remember just sitting with that for weeks, you know, trying to do that in prisms, which is what I started with, you know, before Houdini.
Prisms was the predecessor to Houdini.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, things awesome. Like that. And,
it was awesome.
And, you know, you go project to project, and there's always little problems like that that need to be solved. I mean, that's part of the reason that visual effects is so such an amazing field to get into.
Yeah.
Because it's constantly changing. So, you know, Matthew's talking about just this sort of, it requires a certain quality of personality. You know, you have to have this enormous thirst for knowledge and curiosity that people are striving to look for answers for, or they're just, you know, that you're really interested in all sorts of different subjects, you know.
Right.
Matthew comes from a, you know, a very scientific background.
Yes, very scientific. And
was it fluid dynamics?
Hypersonic and ultrasonic aerodynamics, right?
That was, my thesis. Well, yes, that's one of the things.
I remember very specifically when you were like, well, it was like, Matthew's a rocket scientist. Like, there's no such thing as a rocket scientist. What field did he actually study?
Actually, there is, and it's not me. So my friend Mark Schaefer is a good friend of mine. We went to school together at MIT doing aerospace. And he went on to work I'm trying to think of the name of the company, I probably shouldn't even say it, but literally designing rockets that put satellites into space. So he pretty much was a rocket scientist.
Okay.
I remember going to DC and I got Mark to become much more hedonistic. That was one of the things that I contributed to the group of friends I met at MIT, having come from the drinking culture of England. And he embraced this. And I remember getting there, and he said, "Well, let's watch a movie. I don't have a VCR. I'll go get one." Which is, you know, so he literally went to the store. What would it be, Best Buy, whatever it was? And I remember Mark was looking at one of the VHS machines, and some salesman sort of slithered up alongside and said, "Oh, you don't want this one. You don't have to be a rocket scientist for this one." He points to another one, and Mark just turns to him and says, "I am a rocket scientist." And he sort of just slithered away. It was brilliant. But that's not me. So I cited a real rocket scientist.
But you do know a lot about airflow.
Yes. I spent a lot of time studying fluids. And I do think can be appropriate. I mean,
sure.
I'm with Kelly in that you don't have to make things physically real to make them visually acceptable. But I do think there can be some value in thinking about the underlying processes in order to achieve that.
Right.
Yeah.
But it made me think a lot. It made me think a lot when I was sitting with you, I was thinking a lot about stuff, right? And even when because that was my first interview, so I was wide open just absorbing all this information. And by the time I got to stuff, which is actually my third movie now that I think about it, because I was on iRobot. Between that. And when I was on Stealth, I was really thinking a lot about shading. Like, shading was a big thing. That's when we started the compositing stuff, remember?
All
that. And that's when for those who have listened to the podcast before, they know that that's when I really got angry about Fresnel, because of the Fresnel value on the wing of the plane.
Yeah.
And that's where people were, like, made these memes of me at DD about everything has Fresnel, which has now become the slogan.
Well, you are right.
I am right. But it was a thing I learned, and I remember sitting with you and you and I don't know if you remember this because you were dealing with so many things, but I remember sitting with you and like trying to explain how I thought the reflections need to look in a plane. You're like, "Oh, I get it." And we were talking about it for a long time. And you know, because a plane is basically like a sheet of paper, right? And so when it banks, the reflections go away. And when it goes to the side, it's all reflection, right?
Yeah.
And it was like something I was trying to really do. And we were like not using, you know, we did end up using, but at the beginning, we were not using the real physical value of the Fresnel to get it right. And then they're like, okay, let's do this. And that was, I was very passionate about it. And that's why people always were joking about it with me. But you listened, you know, and you saw it, and we talked about it, and it was a thing that we went through. There was a wonderful thing that experience, and because you're a great listener, Kelly. I mean, I've worked with you on several shows. In fact, the last show I ever worked on was with you. It was Maleficent, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you're great at sort of figuring out the process of what needs to get done, and just, you know, like, and I think what also makes it good is you're very humble, right? You know, I only know so much information, so when I don't know, I'm going to rely on the people that do.
Right? Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's like, okay, Darren Hendler, you tell me exactly what I need to do to fix this problem, because I know this much of the information, but I've got a great troop of people, and that's what you do, right?
I think it's incredibly important for people to sort of remember and realize that this is a... filmmaking in general is an enormously... collaborative effort,
right?
You know, from the director on down, all the department heads, and then obviously still with visual effects, where you have hundreds, literally hundreds of people working on this, and each one of these departments in just visual effects is a career in and of itself. They're all specialists, they're all experts in their field, and so it would be completely stupid of me or anyone in this position to be, you know, talking like we know it all. Like, this right. is absolutely a conversation that has to happen, and you have enormous respect
right.
for someone who's a modeler, and this is what they do for a living, or who's a lighter, or a character rigger, or an animator. They, they all have very important contributions to make to the process. And these are like serious professionals. I mean, we have, you know, it's important to be curious and have fun and have fun with the whole process. And I think that's critical, but man, it's a serious, and difficult, problems that we're solving every day.
Yeah, I agree. But I think it's also fun, right? Let's not kid ourselves. We're not curing cancer.
No.
We're not at all, but what we're doing is we're using our brains to do something fun, right? There's a lot of discussion about, like, you know, the process of creating everything that's on there. Someone was giving me an example. It's like, it's all about problem solving and about talking to people and about new problems that we have to deal with every year or whatever it is. And I said, what you just described could be said for an accountant, right? An accountant has to deal with problem solving, meeting people, solving new problems every year. This is not necessarily a thing, but what we do is, what you add on top of that is a layer of something beautiful on the screen, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think of just the beauty on the screen, but it's a combination of those things. And once every pixel that you see on the screen is a story, right? Everything that you've done, like, I can watch a movie and, like, pause every scene. It's like, okay, so remember on this shot, this mm-hmm. was something really cool that happened. So everything has a story. That's a side story to the story of the actual movie, you know? And so I always love those things. You know, and sometimes you even remember the name of every shot. That was kind of
funny. Yeah, I just mentioned TD-30 today, in fact.
Yeah,
in talking to
which was TD-30,
a Titanic shot.
It was a Titanic shot. It was an underwater shot, and it made reference to the cavitation from the propeller.
Right.
And so it was an underwater shot, and it was actually a fully synthetic shot. And I believe it might have been our first. Fully
CG.
CG shot.
So there was no maquette.
No, there's no, nothing was filmed for that. I remember at the time going, hell. I certainly hadn't done anything like that.
Right.
It was a little nerve wracking because it helps typically to have something that's already real in the scene
to match.
That your brain can lean on.
Right.
And now if you're just adding the fake Coke can in the background, your brain is much more tolerable to it. Whereas if you've got to create everything, nowadays, we do this all the time. In fact, a lot of the time, I'll say, you know what, it's just much easier. don't even shoot that because it's going to, now we're going to have to track the thing, we're going to have to match exactly that. It's like, But back then, it wasn't a tool. It was definitely breaking new ground.
Right. So let's talk about that difference. Let's talk about the differences of the old days. You know, how long you guys have both been at DD? 24 years now, right?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. Two dozen years, right?
Yeah, I was 25 when I started, so it's next year it'll be, I don't even want to think about it.
Right. So that was a long time ago, which is fine, and I think you guys have a good perspective on how things have changed in those years. So what would you say are some of the things that you're happy about changing, or some of the things you miss about changing?
Well, there's so much that's changed. I mean, for one, just an observation on the hardware is really interesting. I think when we first started, it was all Silicon Graphics workstations that were probably, $50,000 to $70,000 a piece, all under our desks. We had a few Onyxes that were giant refrigerator size.
The purple refrigerators.
Mm-hmm. Things that would run our flame, you know, suites.
I still want to get one of those and turn it into like a kegerator or something.
Yeah, that would be good. And those things were like $1 million each.
Yep.
And now you have, for example, you either have workstations or you don't even have workstations anymore. Like we have a situation at Digital Domain now where we don't have any workstations under our desk now. It's all done remotely.
It's all virtual.
Yeah. So we've got a server farm, you know, in some other city, and it's all remotely based, and that's how we work now.
So you're saying
that's a big change.
We're back to dumb terminals.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty crazy. I remember, a lot of the technology has changed.
Yeah.
I remember we were just talking about Titanic and how current deliveries are either DPXs or EXRs now, and now we did Titanic and 8-bit.
RGB.
Yeah. RGB, yeah.
I think we did all of Titanic with 2 terabytes of disk space.
Yep. Which I think I have that much storage on this audio device.
Which is pretty nuts to think about. Now, of course, it didn't take 2 terabytes for the whole movie to do the whole movie, but it took 2 terabytes of disk space. So we had to be very carefully managed, you know.
Right, you had to back it up.
Shots, we could only work on a certain number of shots at a time. And
Everything was scanned and everything was filmed out. That was all.
Right.
Yeah, of course, films, that's film. An enormous Filming. Change.
Film out, I kind of miss film outs a little bit. Don't you?
Yes and no. I mean, we were talking to Ian earlier today, he was asking, do you miss miniatures? And I was responding, one of the things I missed about it was a lot of the time there's some sort of explosion or something, there's a reason why you're doing the miniature. Mm-hmm. And I remember the excitement of going and seeing it the next morning, right? You come into dailies, it's probably because you overcranked the shot, and you couldn't actually view it until you've gone through the whole process of, you expose the negative to the time, now you need to actually process that negative, make a print, get it back, and screen it in the theater. And I pensively looking at, it was either great or not great. That made it kind of exciting.
Yeah.
I sort of miss that, but I don't miss some of the headaches. I don't miss 8-bit. Mm. That was a pain in the ass.
Yeah. But we had a model shot for years, and it was so... I love the tactile quality of having being able to touch a miniature and see it with your own eyes. Its physicality, that's really special.
So I want to touch on this a little bit, because it's a little bit of a bone to pick with the non-visual effects world that seems to be saying it was so much better when it was practical and when it was miniatures, and now it's all CG and it sucks. And I know you guys feel the same way that I do about that a little bit, but I want to hit on a specific point about craftsmanship, right? Mm-hmm. When you're doing miniatures, you are crafting a miniature and it looks, good, generally speaking. I used to come from the world of architecture, right? And I hung out with, Alan Fouché in the model shop back in, nice guy on,
awesome.
passed away, unfortunately, but he was a wonderful, wonderful guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I would talk to him as someone who did architecture, and I did architecture models, because that's what you did in architecture school. You do physical models, right? Yeah. And I would look at these models and they're like, they look great. And then you got really close and they're like, huh. And he's like, I said, why is it that they don't look necessarily as great when you go really close to them? He goes, oh, we only build it to look good from that perspective.
Sure.
Right? Because otherwise it's a waste of time. Yeah. I'm not going to build all this stuff. He's like, for an architecture model, you go right up to it. You want to click it up or do whatever. It's a living thing that you touch.
Yeah, it's built for how it's being viewed.
But it's built for how it's being viewed. And he says, yeah, I've hired architects to do model shop. He's like, they went way too detailed. And it was like, we're burning time here getting onto this stuff. Yeah. So there's a lot of process that I learned from Alan about that. And it's like, that's really important. It's interesting to do. Nowadays, people who are doing set extensions, for example, they're still building models. They're just building them on the computer. Yeah. They're still making things. They're still doing, it's okay, so they don't have to go and find what glue and what piece of wood to put together and what kind of paint they need to use, but they are still building things on the computer, and that's a manual process.
And it's still the same idea, right? You still build it to the level of detail that you need.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's something that we learn from the modeling process that translates to CG. And it's specifically with models and set extensions. Set extensions today in CG are beautiful. In fact, 95% of the time, most people don't realize that what they're looking at is a digital set extension.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that should be celebrated as opposed to saying it's crap because it's CG.
Well, I think that when you hear that, it always kind of bumps me out when it's like, oh, it's CG, therefore it's bad. But
right.
I think
yes.
the bottom line is that there's miniatures, there's good miniatures, and there's bad miniatures. There's good CGI, and there's bad CGI.
Yes.
So I think the problem, the issue is that like people have a problem with bad CGI. Right.
But they just generally made CGI a bad word.
Yeah.
Well, because seeing bad CGI, right?
Yeah.
Right.
They say to themselves, I see that's not real, therefore it was computer generated, and they're picking out the piece that is, by definition, what Katie said, bad, therefore they put it in that box, therefore anything that they can tell is fake, by definition is bad, because they can tell.
Right. Right.
What they're missing, what you say, Chris, is that you're missing the 99% of the content that's in there that they had no idea.
Right. Like Game of Thrones, most of it is extended, you know?
Yeah, and so I think that's, and I think we all have issues with, and this is just, you know, goes to filmmaking in general or any art form that it's like, well, if it takes me out of the movie because I see something that doesn't look real or it looks hokey or it's
right.
animated poorly, then I have a problem with that too. You know, it's just, I think it's when it's seamless and you don't even know it's there or you're so engaged with a particular character that you sort of buy it and you're in the story.
Yeah.
The whole point of visual effects is to support the story.
Yeah.
The whole point of any department, costuming, you know, the set design, everything, every single department is there to support the
story.
Yeah.
Specifically like background, you know what I mean? Like yeah.
Support the story and move it forward in an engaging way so that the audience is enjoying the story being told.
It was. I'm just going to skip ahead to this. I'll get back to the other point. But at the same time, the movie that you just came off of, The Avengers, right? So the Infinity War. Thanos, which I've talked about already with Darren Handler and Chris Nichols, the other Chris Nichols.
Yeah.
And stuff. They've been on the podcast before. Thanos is not a supporting system. Thanos is a lead system.
Yeah.
Right?
He is, yeah.
So that's higher pressure.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, he's got more screen time than any other character. He's definitely the lead in that
right.
film. Like, he's got over 40 minutes of screen time.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's something that's new, too, isn't it? Since the last 24 years?
I mean, Beauty and the Beast was a lead character.
That's
true. Title character, but he didn't have nearly as much screen time, for sure. And, you know, it was a different type of character. And this was, you know, Marvel was very, very, you know, wanting to make sure that this was going to work.
Right.
And so they engaged both Digital Domain and Weta relatively early on to do, even before the shooting began to do, which is kind of a rare thing, you know, to do, you know, several months of R&D development and do a test and make sure, kind of instill the confidence in the directors and the studio.
Well, that's something
to make sure
different
we can pull
from
it off.
The past, right? You're asking that one.
Right.
Because in the past, a lot of what we did was even referred to as post. And
right.
I kind of hate that word. The idea is you can do whatever you want, and then someone will come in and clean up on aisle six, right?
Yeah.
Whereas now the expectation, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, keep going. That's good. It's a good point.
Yeah, it's that now the expectations are so high, and as you just said, maybe Thanos, your lead actor, to be...
He's like the most important character in the whole film.
You have to get in there early, don't you? You have to do what Kelly was just saying. You have to do these tests, your development. You can't... I think post is more of a rarity now, so because there's only so much you can do.
Right.
And it's going to be inefficient, and you can't do a lead actor, but you can... But you certainly can if you get in there early enough. And that's something that has changed over the time that we couldn't do before.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think in it served not only to kind of give a boost of confidence to the filmmakers, but also to, I think, Josh Brolin, the actor who played Thanos, also because he was able to see this test before even he... Like, we showed it to him literally on his first day of shooting the character.
And you were able to...
And so he
turned that around in a day?
Well, no. We'd been working on this for months,
but
he hadn't seen it until literally his first day of shooting.
Right. So he did the test, and then you guys worked on the test and showed it
to him. So he was wearing the helmet cams and just had a very casual conversation with the directors, kind of went in and out of character. We used that footage, made a small little sequence test. Mm-hmm. Both Weta and I kind of...
It's been online, actually.
I think it's online now. You can see it, but... both Weta and Digital Domain, worked on this, and it was actually kind of nerve-wracking because we all went in the sort of a trailer, and it was the Marvel executives, Kevin Feige, and all the Russo brothers, and Dan DeLue, the visual effects supervisor for Marvel, and then Josh Brolin, and watching this test, watching him watch it.
No pressure.
And I'm just like praying that this is going to go well. Those guys had already liked it, but Josh hadn't seen it yet. And what was really interesting to take away from him is that he saw the subtleties of his performance come through in the capture. So prior to that, what was really interesting is that a lot of actors who do playing a character that they know is going to be a digital character, sometimes they overemphasize their facial expressions.
Did I talk to you about this before? Because this is exactly the way I feel. Go ahead, keep going.
Well, because they, I think correctly so, think that some of that nuance of that performance gets filtered out in the sort of the technology as it, it's not capturing all the super subtleties of that.
Yeah.
But he was able to see with this, because we were kind of pushing the envelope with this and actually using new technology that we hadn't used before, he was seeing that performance was coming through. And so he realized then and there that he didn't need to do that. And I think so that he was able to just play it as he wanted to play it without having to go somewhere else, which may have perhaps, come off in a different way, a bigger... So you see in the film itself, there's a lot of very, very subtle performance.
It's an extraordinarily subtle performance for a CG character.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right that it didn't get filtered out. You can see the very nuanced thing. And I love it. I think it's fabulous. And I think you guys did a good job. Now I'm going to ask you a very challenging question, and you can refuse to answer if you want to. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to ask the question.
Uh-oh.
Do you believe that Andy Serkis's performance is driven by the fact that he was trained on systems that couldn't do that, and that's why he acts the way he does?
I don't...
Is there a chicken and the egg situation?
Yeah, I'm not really sure I could even...
Because I'm saying something wrong. He tends to exaggerate a lot of his emotions as an actor, as a person. Now, sometimes that character is correct for the representation he's doing. Even when, on Black Panther, he was a live action character, but he was hyper enthusiastic, right? Overacting a little bit.
Interesting.
And I think that that's something that's driven by the fact that the technology was doing that.
I wonder. I would say maybe no. Okay. If I would just answer it yes or no, like right off the bat, but because I'm thinking of like Gollum or something. And
Gollum is a massively charismatic
looker. Yeah, and so that's that character, though.
But I've never seen Andy Serkis do a...
It kind of works.
I've never seen Andy Serkis do something like Josh Brolin on Thanos. I've never seen
but
him do that.
Isn't Caesar a pretty subtle?
I don't know.
No,
I thought not as much as Brolin. I don't think.
Well, I think it's.
And maybe I'm wrong.
It's a
maybe
different
I'm
character. I thought Caesar was great.
I agree that Caesar was great. And I'm not trying to say that what Andy Serkis did was wrong. I'm just saying that he had been trained as a motion capture performer to exaggerate his motion, right? So Josh Brolin had never, I don't think he'd ever played a CG character.
I think he had. I think he's done a few things. Like, by the way, he is just such an amazing guy to work with.
Was he?
Just so.
Josh Brolin?
Josh Brolin.
Sorry.
So accommodating.
Right.
You know, we kind of put these actors, I really have respect for actors who like have to deal with the requirements of visual effects. because you have to go into it like Dan Stevens on Beauty and the Beast is amazing. Like,
right.
Because you really have to just go put your, you know, he would do the performance on set and then we would, you know, capture it later and he had to recreate the scene and remember how he did it and then kind of just do the whole thing again. Brolin, we had the thing where he could actually capture, and this was all because of the helmet cam. He was all in the set, which is the best way to do it.
You know,
you're interacting with other actors.
Right.
Was he always in the set?
Yeah.
Okay.
So we were able to capture the...
So it was all removing him.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of paint work.
Did just you have to do a lot of pickup stuff, though, where he acted in the set, but then you then did
not post-shoot? Not a little bit, but not too much.
Huh.
Yeah. Hmm. But it was you know, we have to do all sorts of, you know, the data capture in order to get a library of, like, heavy data just so we know how his face moves and make them do weird facial expressions.
Well, that's part of your deep learning stuff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to get to that in a second, but who is one of the people that you worked with that you feel like was something that was amazing, a collaborative person, outside of digital domain?
Like, collaboratively? Well... Gosh, most of them. I mean, I think any good director needs to be collaborative. Was what you guys were saying earlier. You get a better product back, right? If you try and brute force just your ideas, you're going to get something. But if you let everybody else to contribute, you're going to get more by definition. Especially since you're employing a whole bunch of creative people, they want to be able to add, you know, value.
Right.
But to give you an example, I mean, well, Steven Spielberg, he's pretty collaborative. He's incredibly collaborative.
What did you work on with Steven Spielberg?
Oh, Ready Player One.
Oh, on Ready Player One,
Right.
Of course.
So when we started that, that was about 2.5 years ago now, he awarded us a bunch of previs work first, and Scott Meadows and I went down to New York.
Yeah.
Across to New York, I should say. You know, I have to say, Steven's pretty intimidating just because of, you know, the sheer body of work, what he has achieved, what he's done, incredible, right? But went into his office and, gosh, he's such a lovely person. He seems humble. I mean, he was sitting at his desk, he's got his little flat cap on in New York, and he worked beavering away. And then what happens, we went into an office, just the four of us, Steven and his producing partner, Christy. She's also lovely. So it was like Christine, Stephen, myself, and Scott. And we just sat in this room going over previs and just waxing ideas.
Right.
And I was thinking, oh my God, we're sitting actually, careful what you say, because you might end up on film, you know?
Right.
And Scott, I tell you, he contributed so much because of Stephen's, collaborative nature. Same could be said for Gavin Hood on Ender's Game.
Right.
I mean, I remember chatting with him, and he said, well, let's go talk a bit more about some nerdy scientific stuff. And we went over to the firehouse in Venice and sat there and had a beer, and he opened up his laptop. And because he was also the writer, I realized we were talking away, and I wrote, hang on, what are you writing in? He's changing the script, you know?
Right.
And,
but do you think he was borrowing from you because he knew about your science background?
Yeah,
and
I was
everything?
Talking, I just, but you, I just, now you have to think about, careful what you say, you know?
Right.
This is another example of collaboration, though. And gosh, it's fun when they do that
Yeah, absolutely. So absolutely. Cool. Well, I think it's interesting, you know, about Spielberg, because I've heard, and, you know, this is only, you know, second or third hand, but that he is very, very, very good at sort of opening to ideas, right? And specifically about CG, he's actually really open to CG in a big way. Yeah. And he's also when they said they were going to do Ready Player One, there were several things that came to mind about Spielberg. One is he is like the go-to like cultural 80s director in a lot of ways. I mean, he's done a lot of stuff beyond that. But in the 80s, there was stuff that was like important that were Steven Spielberg films, right? That are part of people who grew up, and that's like a Steven Spielberg thing. The other thing that's interesting is that he's also an avid gamer, right? Mm-hmm. He's a massive gaming guy, because I knew someone who worked at DD who happened to be a PA for Spielberg, like before he was at DD, and he was talking about how he had to go out and buy video games for him, like I need a new joystick, and that's his thing. He really loves video games. He plays a lot of them, and he's a big passionate person in this. So Ready Player One was like an environment that was like his, like it's perfect for him. It's like 80s culture, and it's video games, and it's all this stuff. So and you combine that with the fact that he's like really open to lots of new ideas and is into, you know, CG. It must have been pretty amazing to be part of that.
Oh, it was an absolute dream. I got to say, I mean, I really didn't want to finish that project.
Really?
I really didn't. And it kept going. And every time we thought we were done, we found out, oh, Steven's added another shot. I was like, oh, yeah, great.
Because you don't always do that. Sometimes you go like, oh.
You're just done. You're typically, even if it's a fantastic movie, you're often, you know what, I'm done. Just, you know, because it's exhausting, right?
Right.
And this one, it kept going and going and going, and I even joked with Stephen about it, and we went to see him at the end. I said, yeah, I wasn't sure it was ever going to finish. And he goes, no, I didn't want to. I was having so much fun. He was having fun. And he truly was. I mean, let's face it, he doesn't have to do this to make money, right?
Right.
He's doing this because he loves doing this. But it was an absolute blast.
Our second round of cocktails are here.
Oh, how did you do that?
I managed. Thank you.
Magic. Oh, I was just thinking it would be nice to have another drink. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Cheers.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers. Yes. Yes. Here we are. Drain up.
And thank you, Chris, for allowing us not to wear pants during this podcast too. That really
good.
Appreciate
well,
that.
You need to air out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is hot.
It's funny you're talking about him being a gamer, because he did explain all that, and
he did, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely true. But because we did all the motion capture for Steven, part of what was done was creating a virtual camera for him, which was very much like a gaming device. Mm-hmm. So there he was, kid in the candy store. He's in the capture volume, able to real-time interactive. You see, you know, the game engine renders of the environment, but also real-time compute his own camera work too. He had fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a cool thing to be able to work with him.
I know, right? Cool.
Yeah.
It was definitely, as they say, an honor and a privilege. It really was.
It was an honor and a privilege, I'm sure. I love to work with guys. I've seen both those films several times, and it felt nice, specifically because I know you guys so well, you know what I mean? And I wasn't around, I didn't work on any of those films, and I've been kind of like out of production work for a long time. It made me feel a little nostalgic, like I could see the pixels on the screen and I could imagine the stories behind them. And I kind of miss production. I kind of don't miss production. But at that moment, I was like, it felt good to see that and to think and to see your name on the screen and to see your name on the screen and saying, like, I'm so happy for those guys. I'm sure, you know, because you guys have done this for so long and it's been so great. And Didi is just, I've done a lot of podcasts with DD people, obviously, because that's, you know, that's where I cut my chops, and that's where a lot of my closest friends are, right? I mean, I've worked at a lot of visual effects facilities. You know, I've worked at DD twice, beginning and end of my career, and in between there, I worked at a bunch of places. But DD is really something that's very interesting as a culture and as a place that embodies fun camaraderie and stuff. I mean, you guys, when I saw you guys here in Malta, I was like, these guys are just going to tear it up. Dave's is going to have a great time.
Oh, it's tearing us up.
Yeah, yeah, no, true. You guys are going to have a great time. All right, I'm going to mention a story, and Allison can tell us if we have to cut this out, because I think it's a great story between you and I, right?
Okay.
We were on stealth, right? Tell me if you remember the story. You and I were on stealth, and we were both at the firehouse. There was something that was going on. It was near the end of stealth, and we were celebrating some kind of a, you know, milestone or something like that. And you and I had several drinks together, and we were just having a great time. And then you met a person. It's okay, guys, come on through. You met some people there that were Canadian architecture students.
Oh wait, this sounds very familiar.
Right.
Keep going.
And so there was Canadian architecture students, and they were traveling to visit, you know, architecture in Los Angeles. And you said, oh, you gotta meet Chris. He's an architect. And then you met him, and then moments later, you and I were dragging this posse of Canadian architecture students into Digital Domain with our badges so they could see all of the Frank Gehry architecture.
Oh, yes. No, this sounds super familiar. Yeah.
We were, and you were like, come and show it. And they were so proud of it. And they were like taking pictures of the whale and stuff. I was like, I don't know if they should really be doing this or not. This was ages ago. So maybe just a statute of limitation on this. But, but we were really proud of showing Digital Domain and talking about how cool it was, right? Yeah. And then you did something that was probably the thing that we shouldn't do. Is we took him to the screening room and said, okay, put your cameras away. We're going to show you a movie that hasn't come out yet. And we showed him some final shots on stealth. And it made absolutely no sense at all. They're like, what? He's like, it's a plane. It's smart. And they were like, oh, okay. And he's like, you'll see it in movies. It'll be great. And they were so proud. Like, when they came out of there, we like totally made their night. They were like, this has been the best experience. Like, we were just having a drink in a bar in Venice. And then suddenly we're like, got to experience some, you know, movie making process.
This is why you should always drink.
Yeah.
It's you know.
But you were so cool about it. You were the greatest.
Well, I think the it's a love. It's a passion. Like, it's hard work. But if you're not passionate, I mean, this is advice I give to my kids. You know, if you find something that you absolutely are passionate about, and you will highly likely be successful, because that's what's going to drive you to work hard. But when you work hard, it's working hard in a different way when you are passionate about it, because it's much more enjoyable. It's it's not that it's not hard. It still is hard, and there's, you know, ups and downs for it, but it's just something that I'm still to this day passionate about.
I think that's one of the reasons why Digital Domain is the culture that you just talked about, is that because we only employ people who were passionate, because going back to what I said earlier, it's like, you couldn't go to school for this. You had to go and pick people you thought were going to solve problems. So clearly that's what we were there trying to do.
Right.
We were going to work hard. We worked bloody hard, right? I mean, there were times where we didn't leave that building. We slept under our desks. But instilled that sort of lack of capability instilled that type of person, right? Because the tools weren't there, because we had to build them, the people who went to that company were the ones that wanted to solve these issues and who were absolutely passionate and were going to work through the night. And it's a bit like mold. We've never got rid of that, right? It's I mean, that's why Kelly and I think, I speak for you, but are still there, is because of that. If you take that away, then why bother, right?
Right.
If it becomes purely a factory, I'm going to do something else.
Absolutely. I think, you know, like you said, that this, that wasn't a thing, it wasn't a degree for this, or, but I remember as I, however old I was when the original Star Wars came out, and it usually comes out in around Memorial Day, you know?
Right.
Which is like around my birthday, end of May. And so I had a little party, like however old I was, 8 or something, and saw this movie, and I was like, I don't know what that is, but that's what I want to do. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know what you call that.
Right.
But just, like, that was just the coolest thing. And, you know, I went through a bunch of different ideas about careers and things like that in the meantime. In fact, up to, you know, at UCLA, I was a history major. So I, like Matthew was saying, there's no degree for this, but I took lots of film classes.
A lot of history majors in visual effects.
Yeah. but it's, you know, there... But part of it is filmmaking is like history and explore and the curiosity about the world, you know. So having a knowledge of the world is incredibly important to creativity in general, because you can pull things from a lot of different areas, you know, have an appreciation for art and photography and technology, all sorts of things allow you to, if you have a very myopic view of the world and you kind of only look in this sort of narrow thing, you don't have a lot of things to pull from. And creativity is really interesting because it's the combination of things that don't always, you know, it's obvious, you know, it's
right.
Like putting things together in a unique way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Excellent. Yeah.
In fact, it really annoys me when I hear people say, if you're this type of person, then you can't be that type of person, right? Like, if you're creative, then you're not going to be able to be scientifically astute, or vice versa. And it's like it's bollocks.
And there was a moment, and I think it's actually much less now. There was a moment in visual effects where it was you were segmented into areas. You're a modeler. You're a character modeler. You're a lighter. You're a compositor. Texture painter.
That way today, too.
And it's hard to get out of that role.
Yeah.
But
well,
I think
DD is one of the best places to be able to move laterally.
It is good. And also I feel that, and in general in the industry, but DD I'm sure is in the same boat, the concept of generalists is actually becoming more popular at high-end visual effects, right? Generalists are always popular in episodic work and have always been very good in that area. But now for high-end visual effects, it's much more that way.
Yeah. Well, I think there's, to some degree, I think there needs to be a place for generalists for sure. But it's still, it's by definition, if you know a lot of stuff, you're not going to know one thing as well as as sometimes we need. So we need specialists in, for example, facial modeling, having a very skilled knowledge of anatomy and facial anatomy and things like that.
Now and then you need a Dan Platt, right?
It's all that kind of stuff.
But even look at Chris Nichols, right? The way that he... When I knew him when he first started DD, he was pretty much just doing textures, mm-hmm. right? He was a very good texture artist and a high-end specialist texture artist. But he did more than that when he went into Thanos, because he became look development. He did some sculpting and some, you know, modeling and textures as well, right? So he's able to contribute. He's able to see. The problem is that it's the classic lighter compositor fight, right? Lighters do something and then they hand it off compositing, and compositors complain about everything that came out of lighting, right?
Yeah.
But if the lighter worked closely with a compositor, or, you know, aided in the compositing process, then suddenly that process becomes a lot smoother, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like I'm done because I'm the lighter and you have to figure it out from here.
That's I agree, and that's experience and communication, right? And that's what separates the men from the boys,
right?
So you look at those seasoned people, you have to name, I don't even want to name them, but they are who they are because they're experienced and they have educated themselves and things around them because they have been stuck in the same room and they have communicated.
Right.
So yes, absolutely, those people are the gems. And you want that. But with Kelly, you still need to, if you're solving this narrow wave problem here, you might need to have
A general small credit.
No.
Yeah. No, I know what you mean. I'm not trying to say everyone should be a generalist, because then you get general work. But you know, you need something else besides that. And I think there's that communication to happen. And that we mentioned earlier that the factory, right? Mm. I worked at a place that was the factory for about, not, it wasn't literally called that, I'm not going to name what it was, but for about 9 months I was there. And I was like, my job was to do my work, pass it on, mm-hmm. and then look at my, you know, documents or email or my spreadsheet and mm-hmm. say, oh, based on this ticket report, I have to fix this, this, and this. I never talked to anyone down or up the mm-hmm. pipe. It was kind of ridiculous.
That's crap. And that's not what DD, I mean, DD has a lot of faults, right? And I can say it because I've been there so long, right? And I'm not trying to sugarcoat it, but what it does have is the opposite of that.
Right.
You can be rogue. You can
go down the hall and call someone. Yeah.
But then you better work hard and you better be passionate. You know, it's not one or the other.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what's one of your favorite stories, Matthew? Come on, you can do
favorite
this.
Stories just in general?
Yeah. God. Favorite stories from DD. Yeah.
Over the last 24 years, favorite stories.
You were the inspiration for Martini Night.
No, I don't think it was me.
Well, we did it on your show.
Oh, well, yeah, I'm sure that you can blame me for lots of things.
It was on your show that we did it.
Yeah. Gosh, that was good, wasn't it? Martini Night.
It's because we needed some drinks on that show.
Yeah, we did. It was a good show. You know what? I'm going to tell you something else that I really appreciate about that show. This was my first movie in visual effects, right? And it was an extraordinarily stressful situation, and we've actually talked about it on the podcast before, so you don't have to worry about that. But it was very stressful from the client side, and you bore the grunt of that. Mm. But you also had this incredible, like, Captain America shield in front of you. And there was a lot of ricochet that was happening off that and would go backwards. And that was all caught by the CG Soup team.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. You
know? Yeah.
And then, so you bore the grunt of it, and then they dealt with the ricochet of it, you know?
That's a good way to describe it.
And then by the time I got it, it was like, I knew something was going on, but I never felt that I did anything wrong.
Right.
I always felt that we were doing the right thing.
Well, and I think we were.
We were doing the right thing. Yeah. But you did an amazing job, and I knew it took a huge toll on you. It took a huge toll on you to do that. And it was... I became a VFX supervisor later in my career. And there are certain things that I learned by observing other visual effects supervisors in the world. And one of them was Kevin Mack.
Yeah.
Kevin Mack has a great demeanor. You guys both know Kevin, obviously.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah. And so Kevin Mack has such a great demeanor in the way that he asks to solve a problem. He always gives you extraordinarily detail about it, makes a huge joke about it, and then says thank you for your work, and you by the time you're out the door to work on your shot, you're extremely inspired, and you can't wait to help him, right?
He is someone I learned a lot from, and I aspire to be Kevin. I love Kevin.
Right.
Who doesn't? I'll give you an example. I remember watching him in action as a visual effects supervisor in the screening room. As you say, he's always so enthusiastic, and he's so warm and complimentary. Mm-hmm. And I remember listening, I don't know whose shot it was, and basically...
Which show was it, do you remember?
I don't think it matters. I'm not sure what it was, because it doesn't actually matter who this was or what it was, but it started with Kevin laying all these compliments. You know, oh, this is awesome, blah, 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 blah. And so now the artist is already excited and engaged. I swear to God, by the time he was done, he's like, this is fantastic. Maybe we should do this here, and we should add this here. And by the time he was done, he changed everything. Everything completely. Like this direction was like, basically, you could have come in and said, this is shit, right? Let's start again. this is what I want you to do.
Right.
But he didn't, right? He took them on this guided tour, and they came out, you know, shouting arms in the air, yeah, this is great, I'm gonna go do this, because that's how clever Kevin is.
Yeah, he loves my shot, I just have to change everything in it.
Yes, exactly. And it's not like he's a manipulative person. I mean, if you were to
compose
this.
No, he's not.
He's just absolutely genuine.
Yeah.
But like, okay, I'm gonna learn from that.
Yeah.
Absolutely learn from that, because you need people to own their craft, right? They have to walk out of there and go, I'm gonna come back and nail this, right?
Well, it's probably
extremely important.
It's probably what happened, because I didn't work with Kevin until later, right? Mm-hmm. So my first one was with you, but you obviously learned from Kevin in some way in that. But what I learned from you was how do you put up that Captain America shield, right? You know, how do you do that situation where someone's really pissed off and you're going to take the grunt of it, because that's where you are, and you're going to put that shield up, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I worked on, you know, I just know it's Eric Barba is a strong person and a strong personality, and I know Eric very well, and we're actually very good friends, but sometimes he can get really pissed off about something, right? But he's not going to yell at the artist. He's going to yell at me because he knows I can take it. Right? And he's going to yell at me about something that the artist did. And I'm going to like, how am I going to deliver this news and not just pass on the yelling to the artist?
Right.
Because he can't do that. That's not the right way to go. And leadership doesn't happen that way. Leadership doesn't live like, well, he's pissed off, so I'm going to yell at this person, so this person has to deal with all of it. Yeah. And you did that, right? You made us feel like everything you guys are doing is awesome. What's going on?
Because
it was awesome.
Yeah.
And what all this stuff that you're hearing about, yes, it's happening. You were not hiding it from us, but you were making us realize like it's not because of what we're doing. It's some other situation that's happening. And in the end, I'm still proud of that movie.
I'm still
proud of that movie. And you know, and it was my first chance to be here, and you know, Mel is here, right?
Yeah.
Which Mel was my first boss. She was the modeling supervisor on that show, right?
All right.
So
cool. That, yeah.
And so I had to, you know, Andy Wastler obviously was my CG soup on that. And he was an ex-architect, right? And he knew that I could model buildings, right? That's what I did. It's like, I was an architect, so if you want me to model all of New York, I can do that. I know exactly how to model buildings. And it was fun. It was like the perfect movie for me to get into the industry and to do that kind of stuff. And then I go and watch the movie and I can see all my buildings. I know exactly, you know, H45 and I-65, because we had them all named that way on the blocks. And it was awesome. It was a lot of fun to do that. So DD gave me that, and I appreciate it. And I learned a lot from that. So while that show was a struggle, it was the best learning experience for me. And it was because people like you guys were there to make me understand where I want to be, and also aspire to be that. Mm. You know, I aspire to be people like you. Like, I didn't look at you guys and say, that guy's, you know, tough boss or whatever.
That's lovely to hear.
Yeah. So I aspire to be that kind of person. And I hope that when I became a supervisor, that I was that person. That's really what I wanted to do. So
that's cool. Yeah, I mean, there's like what you're saying with Kevin. There's this idea of, there's certainly one responsibility of a supervisor is to sort of protect to some degree the crew from certain things, but they're all grown-ups and professionals. So, but you need to filter some of that, because it's not productive. You know, like there's certain things that maybe, you know, that you know more of the story, you know, for example, that it's just not, it doesn't help anybody, you know. So there's a certain aspect to that. And then there's also this, it is a learning experience. So when Kevin's like talking about this, and I've taken this approach, is that when I'm giving creative direction, I actually explain why I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't just say, you know, let's get a little bit more atmosphere over here, or talk about his walk or something, like, because I'm often, you know, it's very important to look at shots in sequence in continuity order, and because at the end of the day we are making a movie and it's not just analyzing a particular shot, you know. So
there's context you're giving.
Yeah, so I like to try to bring the artist in as much as possible in the collaborative process and actually say, what do you think? Let's look at this, you know, with a couple shots on either end of it. Let's see it in context. And you know what? Something's not consistent with the atmosphere. Actually, yours is pretty good. Let's go back to this other shot that we're not even looking at and add a little bit more atmosphere on that shot, just so it kind of goes right across the sequence together in a more seamless way.
Yeah.
So you're kind of bringing them into the fold in a way, like in helping them understand, like, you're not just a machine that's, you know, putting your stamp on it. You're actually like a part of the creative process, and you're actually learning why these decisions are being made.
Yeah.
And it makes it a lot more palatable, you know, to go back and change it at that point.
Yeah, yeah. And we employ very sensitive artists, you know, for a good reason. So then you got to like treat them like that. You start treating them like widgets, you're going to get nothing back.
Right.
And I couldn't agree more with Kelly. You know, you need people to have that ownership. They need to go to seize it and take it. And they're not stupid, you know, let's not patronize them. As Kelly said, let's educate what it is you're trying to achieve. And then you're going to cut through the communication barrier problem. Because if you say you just give Bach orders, well, for one thing, half the time the notes come back from complete 180 from what you said, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you literally just take the words, you're going to get back something that's a pickle, you know? Whereas if you explain what it is you're trying to achieve, then you let them
do their own take on it. Yeah.
Exactly. Then clearly it's going to be better. Yes. I think that I might be misquoting here. I think it was Kevin Mack again that talked about, I think it was Ron Howard. And so forgive me all those people if I get this wrong, but what I took, and it doesn't matter because what I took from it is more important. But what I heard was that Ron said that if you have an idea and you're passionate about your idea, but the other person has their idea, and if you think that your idea is better, but theirs is pretty good, go with their idea, because they will own that idea, and what you'll get back from that is going to be so much more than trying to beat someone over the head, shoehorning them into your idea.
There.
So,
yeah.
That's so
because they're going to have to execute it. Yeah. So they have the responsibility of execution. Now.
Yeah.
What you end of the day, you'll get back is something better than
you give them ownership.
Beating up.
Yeah.
And it's just so smart. It's obvious when you think about it.
Yeah,
and
it's brilliant.
Yeah. And I think we all do that.
Yeah.
Implicitly, we may not think about it, but we've been doing it long enough that you learn how to get more success out of your artists. And I think what it is letting them be artists.
You know, now that I think about that exact story, I was on Oblivion, and it was a very similar situation. I had an artist that was working on a really crap shot, right? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't his fault. It was just really crap, and he had bad elements, bad stuff to deal with. Just couldn't do it, and so I was struggling with it, just like. I was like, well, we just got to start just moving along the pipe. You know, it's just got to get something going. So I told him, just render what you got out of it, just so we have it like a first pass out. Mm-hmm. And then we'll figure out all the things we need to fix, right? So he did, and then there was not much progress. And I was like, well, okay, we'll just do another pass, and it's fine, and keep going. And so specifically Eric was like very upset about this. It's like, this is looking like crap. And he was like, what's wrong with his art? It's like, well, it's my fault. I was like, and I'm trying to explain. It's like, I'm not too happy about what he's doing. I was like, okay, well, we have to fix these problems. And I defended the artist really strongly because I was the middleman, right, in this situation. Mm-hmm. I defended him really hard. It's like, he's a good artist. I guarantee you. He's like, okay, Chris, I believe you. I believe he's a good artist. And I said, so I'm going to prove this to you. Because I felt really strongly about this artist. I think just because what you're seeing is not his fault, right? And he said, okay. And then there was this really big, complicated shot in Oblivion, which involved going, like the drone coming down and going around.
Yeah,
to, you know,
yeah, yeah.
It was all CG, right?
It's unreal, yeah.
It's all CG. And I said, remember that artist that you're having a hard time with? I'm going to give him that shot. I'm going to give him complete control of that shot. And he's going to do the whole thing. He goes, okay. And Eric was like, all right, let's do it. And he did it. And I very methodically dissected everything you need to do, but like it's like I'm giving you very little responsibility except this. And that shot just slowly moved through the pipeline. I mean, and it was, it's not just him, but he dealt with the lighting part, but he did the communication. He worked very closely with the modeling team, worked very closely with the texturing team, worked very closely with the compositor, and they all worked together as a team. I barely had to give him any direction. I gave him ownership, right? Mm-hmm. And that shot's beautiful. It's an amazing shot.
Absolutely.
And that's the thing. I think you're right. It was like, give him ownership. Ownership, yeah. Sometimes, if you trust the person, and it was a gamble. I took a gamble. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've got to employ good people. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
It doesn't employ good people.
Yeah. But if you give him ownership, it's amazing what you get out of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Especially in this field, right? Because it's artistry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Well, guys, it's been over an hour, but have you guys had fun?
Cool. Awesome. Wow, that went fast.
It did. We only had two drinks.
Well, we can have more after. But I really appreciate you doing this, and hopefully you guys had fun chatting on the
absolutely. The podcast. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah. So we will continue to enjoy THU. What do you guys think of THU so far?
Oh, it's good.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
No, it's fantastic.
It's only been like a couple of days, and you still guys have like 3 or 4 days to go. So, yeah. So pace yourself.
Oh, my God. Well, I think Malta is so beautiful.
Right.
Yeah. And it's what a great setting for it, too, you know?
Yeah.
I think you should always be here.
Yeah.
It will be here for at least 3 years.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they have a contract. So it's going to be here for at least 3 years, which is great. The city of Malta has been very generous with us. And sort of making something really cool with this. And we're in this small area called Valletta, which is kind of this very pedestrian medieval town. I'm extraordinarily impressed with it so far. So this is my fifth THU, so I'm kind of like an old veteran in this
area. Yeah.
But I love it. So like I said, I'm really glad you guys could come to the THU and sort of experience this. And we will be doing this for several nights and continuing to bond with people here. So
fantastic. Right. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, guys.